The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon.
To quote the writer Leon Uris, a republic eventually came to pass, but the sorrows and the troubles have never left that tragic, lovely land. For you see, in Ireland, there is no future, only the past happening over and over. When Uris published those words in 1976 in his book Trinity, about Ireland, he reflected well on a situation then already a decade old, but still bewildering to outsiders. The Troubles, or the Irish question, as it became known across the North Sea. Indeed, when the Troubles started in Northern Ireland in late 1960s, it took most people in the world by surprise. It shouldn't have, as our speaker today could tell us. For the years of violence and suffering that Northern Ireland endured for the last quarter century are the same as those of its earlier years, what Lady Gregory once called its hatred answering hatred. Ireland long has been a land divided, first by force and then by choice. Its history is one of contradiction, contrast, confusion. It should come as no surprise, then, that the man who is now at her helm and enjoying swelling popularity is the same man who, only a few short months ago, was seen as a political leader on the way down. It is only because of the vagaries of Irish politics that as unlikely a politician as the farmer barrister John Bruton could succeed to the top of his country. He has stayed there a remarkable 4 months, overseeing overseeing a fragile coalition government composed of his conservative Fine Gael party, a left-of-center Labour party, and a Marxist-oriented Democratic left. His low-key demeanor has helped him to keep the peace process going, to produce the joint framework document announced in February, a document that many believe will lead to an end to the bloodletting in Northern Ireland and provide that troubled land at long last with a future of promise rather than a regurgitation of the past. Born in Dublin in 1947, the farmer from County Meath entered politics in 1969 when he was elected the youngest member of the Dáil, Ireland's equivalent of the U.S. Congress. After serving in top ministry jobs as the coalition's governments came and went over the years, Mr. Bruton was elected leader of the Fine Gael party in 1990, holding it together despite the Irish media's cynicism about his quiet simplicity and apparent lack of charisma, whatever that is. His party's own disenchantment with him finally nearly cost him his leadership position last year. But Mr. Bruton's talent has emerged in recent months. Since becoming the new prime minister, or Taoiseach, I got it right, Taoiseach, he has seized the opportunity to shine, winning a standing ovation in the Dáil for helping to get the peace agreement between Northern Ireland and Britain to stick. Like the Irish blessing so often quoted on St. Patrick's Day, the road clearly has risen up to meet him. Mr. Prime Minister, yours.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start by thanking you for Your very eloquent introduction, and for the enormous amount of research you did into my career, I certainly do lack charisma. That I will definitely concede, and I have no ambition to acquire it. I want to say I'm really pleased to be here on St. Patrick's Day in the footsteps of many very distinguished Irish leaders who've spoken here at the National Press Club throughout the long history of this club. And I'm very conscious indeed of the fact that I had the privilege of being the first leader of an Irish state to speak here in Washington in the case of a state that is now at peace. Nobody can understate the importance of the fact that Ireland is now at peace with itself. And I want to stress the importance of the contribution that the United States has made to the achievement of this. I believe the President in particular has shown great wisdom in initially, for example, granting a visa to Mr. Gerry Adams, which created a condition in which Mr. Adams and his supporters could see that there were dividends to be reaped from pursuing the path of peace, that you would get political recognition and encouragement if you gave up the gun. And that crucial decision last August of the IRA to stop violence led to a decision some months later of the loyalist paramilitary organizations to give up violence as well. But the encouragement of the United States in this process was extremely important. Because I think one should never underestimate the extent to which people in Ireland look to the United States for inspiration and encouragement. I suppose it's a two-way process also, because in 1772, Benjamin Franklin visited the Irish Parliament in Dublin, and he found, and he wrote to one of his friends, that he found that the members of the Irish Parliament at that time were, and I quote, disposed to be friends of America. Well, I have no doubt, thank you, I have no doubt that that still remains the case, but it is equally the case that members of the Congress of the United States, from my meetings with them yesterday, are certainly disposed also to be friends of Ireland. I particularly believe that the American genius of making unity out of diversity has tremendous application to the solution of the problems of Ireland at this time. We have two traditions in Ireland which clash. One of those traditions believes it's British. They believe they're part of the great British ideal, which was originally a multinational entity, the British Empire and indeed the United Kingdom, combining three different nations or four different nations under one king. They believe that they're part of that, and they believe that that's a valid and sophisticated arrangement. Equally, you have the nationalist tradition of the island of Ireland, which rejects that, which rejects all the symbols that are associated with it, including the monarchy, and says, no, we want to be part of a united Ireland, an Irish entity, excluding connection with Britain. There is a very fundamental clash, and in fact, if you put the issue starkly in terms of who owns the land of Ireland, or whose flag should fly on its public buildings, if you put the question in those stark terms, there is no answer. Because for one side to be pleased, the other has to be displeased. And we all know that in the case of Ireland, people who are displeased don't give up the fight. So we've got to find a new way of putting the question, where we get not an answer that will displease one by pleasing the other or vice versa, but an answer to which both can give their assent. And that's what we're trying to do, British Prime Minister and I, to whom I pay tribute for his courage in very difficult situations, for the way in which he has given leadership on the Irish question. We, the British Prime Minister and I, are trying to frame the Irish question in a new way, to devise structures within Northern Ireland which both unionists and nationalists can feel that they own. And I think this question of ownership is crucial. If a political solution is to work, it doesn't necessarily have to be a brilliant concept. What it does necessarily have to be is something which the people who are working it feel that they made, that they contributed, that they created, whatever the system is. So the two governments, the British and Irish governments, came together and they laid out a framework, a sketch, if you like, of what might be a possible solution, whereby, if you like, the nationalist part of the community in Northern Ireland were told, you're going to have all Ireland structures. You'll have links with the Republic, links with the South. You're not going to be isolated anymore. You're not going to be treated as a minority anymore because you're going to be linked to the Catholic nationalist majority on the island of Ireland. But equally, we said to the Unionists, to give them a sense of security and belonging, we're not going to remove the link with the United Kingdom. Northern Ireland is still all going to remain a part of the United Kingdom, but under a new dispensation where both nationalist and Unionist could equally feel ownership. And we set out this in some detail. But we also said very clearly that this is just a document for discussion. And it is for the parties in Northern Ireland itself to come up with something better if they believe the document isn't an adequate balance of the interests involved. And I believe that we've been quite successful in that because I see already the parties in Northern Ireland are coming forward with their own ideas, different perhaps from those of the governments, but attempting at least to tackle the problems that are there, that underlie the necessity of structures that enable two different groups of people with differing allegiances to share the same piece of ground. And if we can find in Ireland a formula that enables that to be achieved, that formula will give hope to the many other nationalities in Central and Eastern Europe where you have two peoples sharing the one piece of ground with a conflict about allegiance. In Estonia, for example, you have an Estonian majority who want Estonian independence and a Russian minority who want to be part of Greater Russia. In parts Transylvania, you have very substantial Hungarian minorities who don't want to be part of Romania, and yet they have to share the land, share the streets with Romanians who very much want to be part of Romania. And as long as questions like that, including the Irish question, are posed in terms of who's going to be top dog, whose flag is going to fly, who's going to be the owner of the territory, you're never going to have peace because one side has to lose. And what we're seeking to do, if you like, is to take the federal idea, which led to the foundation of the United States, and the federal idea that's leading now to the creation of a union in Europe, the great European Union, and apply that concept to Ireland, to find a way, if you like, where you can federalise the problem of Ireland by creating multiple allegiances where previously there only was one allegiance, one flag, one nation, one land, to have the possibility that the individual could have their own allegiance while living on the same street with somebody else in harmony who had a slightly different allegiance. To create, for example, the possibility that it could be the case that one person on a street in Belfast would say, I'm Irish and nothing but Irish, and I don't have any allegiance to anybody else. While their neighbour would say, well, I'm Irish, but I'm also British. And that the two of them could live happily together. Just as it is the case now that there are people in Catalonia, for example, in northern Spain, who say, I'm Catalan. And there are others, their neighbours, who say, well, I'm Catalan, but I'm also Spanish. And yet they can live very happily together. If we can get the same sense of creating this idea of multiple allegiance for individuals, where it is the person ultimately, not the land, the person that's sovereign about their own future, I think we can make tremendous strides forward. And it is, I believe, a very realistic concept. Because nowadays, whereas in the 19th century, land was the crucial factor of production. Agricultural land was the real form of wealth, certainly in the 18th century. Therefore, the question of who owned the land was of crucial significance. Now in the 20th century, land is no longer of great importance. Agricultural products are in surplus, so who owns the land isn't of such great importance. It's knowledge. It's the ability to travel from one country to another. It's the ability to get information from another part of the world, apply it in one part of the world, and produce products to be sold in yet another part of the world. It's that concept of movement of knowledge and movement of people that really creates wealth in this, the 20th and soon to be 21st centuries. So the idea of territorial sovereignty, of ownership of land, is no longer relevant in the modern world. And what we need to do, and what we're trying to do in Ireland, is to redefine the concept of nationality so that it suits the realities of the 21st century and isn't mired in the concepts that
were the cause of so much war in Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries. Now, where do we go from here? I believe that there are four things that need to be done now that we have peace in Ireland, now that we have a framework set out by the governments as to what the governments think might be a solution. There are four steps that need to be taken to bring us on to the next stage. First of all, we need to get the politicians in Northern Ireland talking to one another. Believe it or not, there are politicians who will go to America, who will go to Britain, who will go to the ends of the world to talk to audiences like this, but who are not engaged in serious constructive dialogue with politicians of the other tradition in their own home in Northern Ireland. We've got to get them talking to one another, and I particularly believe the Unionist Party, who have been a bit reluctant about this, are going to have to come forward and start talking seriously to the nationalist community. Secondly, we've got to get the arms that are a hangover or a holdover from the period when violence was part of our lives, 25 years of it. We've got to get those arms put out of commission. And it's not just a question of putting them out of commission because we're worried or believe that they're going to be necessarily used again. We don't. I don't believe they will. But the fact is that there are victims of violence in Northern Ireland. People who may have lost a loved one as a result of either IRA or loyalist violence. And they're never going to rest really easy in their beds. And they're never really going to be willing to let their politicians talk to the politicians who represented the parties that previously used violence until the gun has been pushed over the cliff and isn't available for use again. It's important that that gesture be made. We've also got to change the way in which the police operate within Northern Ireland. The fact of the matter is that the Royal Ulster Constabulary is acceptable to the majority, perhaps the overwhelming majority of the people in Northern Ireland. But there is a significant minority to whom the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, is not acceptable. And it needs to be reformed so that everybody can give their allegiance to the police force. Because an effective and accepted police force is one of the essentials of a civil society based on trust, agreement and democracy. And finally, we've got to get movement on the release of prisoners. There are many people who were sentenced to long sentences of imprisonment for acts that they took part in as part of the armed struggle of either the Loyalist or the Republican sides. Now that their organisations have given up violence, it is sensible to consider releasing these people earlier than they would otherwise have been released, because they no longer are a threat. Their likelihood of their reoffending is minimal at this stage. So we can, with safety, release them back to their families and their neighbourhoods, where they can make a much more constructive contribution than they can within the walls of a prison. So there are those four steps that we could now take. Get the politicians talking to one another, dump the arms, reform the police, and release the prisoners. Those are the next steps along the road. And after that, hopefully, we'll be able to get a complete agreement on a settlement, perhaps not precisely the settlement set out by the governments in the framework document, which I've described to you in general terms, but a settlement agreed by the two communities in Northern Ireland. If they can agree on a settlement, all of us, whether we be in the United States, in Dublin, in London, we'll be more than willing to back that settlement and make it work. There's a lot of work to be done, but a lot of progress has been made already, and it's progress for which, as I told him today, the President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton, can take enormous personal credit. Thank you.
Now comes the hard part, the question. What explanation do you have for the reported discovery of the bomb in Northern Ireland today, and do you think that the IRA or other Republican terrorist groups have any linkage to that?
I don't think that the IRA has any linkage to it. I believe that there may be a group that wants to wreck the peace process that have been involved. They may be people who call themselves Republican, but they are not connected, in my view, with the Sinn Féin or IRA organizations.
How and when will the IRA lay down its arms?
That's a matter that I think they have to decide for themselves as far as the detail is concerned. It's important, as I said in my address, that any step that's taken is one in which those taking it feel a sense of ownership, that it is their decision, their concession, their compromise, their offer, their generosity that's being expressed. So it is not for me to lay down the detail. If I did that, I'd be taking that ability, that sense of ownership, away from them and putting them in a corner and pushing them to do something in a way that they haven't decided for themselves. If this decommissioning of arms is to work, it has to be decided by the people concerned themselves. Now, it is legitimate for me to ask them to tackle the issue. It's legitimate for me to keep coming back to the issue every time I'm asked about it and saying, yes, you must get the arms out of commission, because unless you do, you won't be able to open serious dialogue with the unionists who've been the victims of violence in the past. It's legitimate for me to ask that question, to put it to them, but it is for them to work out the details, so long as they do it reasonably soon.
You have expressed your approval of the President's decision to allow Mr. Adams to come here for fundraising purposes. The question is anyone going to monitor that fundraising and see where the funds are going and how they are used? And could they be used, someone else asked, could they be used to increase an arsenal?
The IRA arsenal is so large that there's no need for them to increase it. They have huge amounts of weaponry which were imported to Ireland over a number of years. So any money that they raise is most unlikely to be used for that purpose anyway. But I believe that the US authorities have stipulated quite substantial safeguards in regard to the accounting for any money received to ensure that it is not used for any purpose of this kind other than for normal political advocacy.
The Protestant Unionists and John Hume's moderate SDLP compose the largest portion of the population in Northern Ireland. Should President Clinton pay as much attention to those elements as he apparently is showing toward Gerry Adams and the Sinn Féin?
I believe he should pay probably more attention to people that have a large number of people voting for them than he should pay to those who have a small number of people voting for him. And I welcome, therefore, the fact that he has invited the leaders of the Unionist Party, various unionist parties, to come to the White House tonight. Now, some of them, most of them indeed, for one reason or another, have decided not to accept the invitation. But it is the case that Vice President Gore, for example, and Mr. Tony Lake have had very serious discussions with the unionist parties. As far as the SDLP is concerned, Mr. John Hume has a long-standing access to the White House, and met the President yesterday and will be meeting him again this evening. I believe it is very important that the whole range of parties in Northern Ireland who support democratic activities should feel that their interests are valued in the United States. I believe it's important in particular that those of the traditional unionist view, British unionist view, who sometimes feel that they have no friends in the world, that they should be shown that they too have concerned friends in America who are willing to listen to their point of view and ensure that it is put into the dialogue along with the views of the nationalist community. Unless both communities in Northern Ireland feel ownership of the problem and ownership of the solution, there will be no solution. And the fact of the matter is that the nationalist community in Northern Ireland will never get what they want unless the unionists agree, and the unionists will never get what they want unless the nationalists agree. They're actually tied together inextricably, and it is for them to find with our help, a way of living productively together rather than in conflict.
Number of questions seek to elicit your views of the Irish position, of the Protestant position in Northern Ireland. Are the Protestants simply paranoid about Adams and Sinn Féin and IRA, or do they have a legitimate concern and reason to be reluctant and reticent about engaging in this process?
They have a very legitimate concern. It is important to bear in mind that for 25 years, their community was at the receiving end of IRA violence. Many members of the police forces, who were mostly Protestant, have been shot by the IRA. Even people who were retired members of the police forces were shot because they had once been members of the police forces. So there are many reasons why unionists feel concern, and particularly feel concern as long as the arms that were used in these killings are still hidden somewhere. So it's quite reasonable for them to, shall we say, be reticent, to ask questions, and to insist on answers. And I think those of us who want a solution must ensure that their concerns, for example, in regard to the decommissioning of arms, are kept up high on the agenda, and that the issue keeps being raised about the arms until the arms are put out of commission. But we've also got to ensure at the same time that it's not the only item on the agenda, and that their representatives, the Unionist Party's representatives, are asked also to engage in serious dialogue, and that we recognise that there are two sides to this issue, that all have fears, and it's only when the fears of both communities are addressed that either community will feel secure or happy.
You mentioned it as one of the issues that must be addressed is the operation of the police in Northern Ireland. Questioner asks, do you see a united federal police force for North and South evolving?
I doubt if that would be acceptable to the unionist majority in Northern Ireland, and while it might be a good idea in theory, it wouldn't work in practice unless it had the acceptability of the majority unionist population in Northern Ireland. Just as, if you like, the Royal Ulster Constabulary has a problem of acceptability to the nationalist minority, or some parts of the nationalist minority in Northern Ireland, because it is defined in those terms as being an entity set up within Northern Ireland with no input adequate from the nationalist community. I think just as that's unacceptable to them, an All-Ireland police force would be equally and perhaps even more unacceptable to the unionist majority. So I don't see that as a practical solution to the problem. What we need to achieve is reform of the police force within Northern Ireland, accompanied by political structures in which both unionists and nationalists feel complete ownership and acceptance. The reform of the police has to be placed in the context of overall political arrangements with which both are happy, so that, if you like, the democratic control of the police is one that is exercised in concord between both communities.
Apart from general encouragement of investment, do the Irish and British governments have any specific plans to protect and increase jobs in Northern Ireland?
Well, one of the things that we're hoping to do to increase jobs in Northern Ireland is to bring more tourists to visit Northern Ireland. And the fact now is that, well, in the past rather, many people would have been reluctant to visit Northern Ireland, and some were even reluctant to visit Southern Ireland because of the existence of violence and the imagery of bombs and explosions and so forth on television screens. Well, now that the violence has ended, it's very practical to bring many, many tourists to Ireland. It's also a very good investment location, both sides of the border. And we're working to, with the US administration, for example, on an investment conference in Ireland, on the issue of Ireland, to take place in Washington in May. And we hope that as a result of that, many more US companies will be willing to either invest in Ireland or participate in joint ventures in Ireland or to source some materials in Ireland from Irish firms, both north and south.
Do you think the peace process that you have described would continue if the Labour Party should come to power in England?
Yes.
What is the significance of the U.S.-Irish Economic Conference in May?
Its significance is, first of all, that the U.S. President and the administration has said Ireland and peace in Ireland is so important that we're willing to devote a substantial amount of time and money to encouraging people to invest in Ireland so that there will be a jobs dividend for those who have given up violence and those who supported violence in the past, who will now see that peace and non-violence leads to more employment. It's that political demonstration that's of great importance. Of equally great importance is the practical outcome of this conference. I'm hoping it won't be a political junket where people go there so that they will be seen to be photographed with important people, or that they'll have a good time in the Dubliner afterwards, or wherever else, the Irish Times, or the other appropriate place for having a good time is in Washington. I hope that it won't be that sort of a conference attended by a lot of politicians who rubbing shoulders with other politicians who can do a good deal of work sometimes, but this is not the place for them, in my view. The sort of people we want to see at this conference are people who can make deals. People who have money to spend and other people who need money to expand their business. And I hope that out of this conference and of the process that it will establish will come, if you like, some form of American-Irish venture capital industry with investments going both ways across the Atlantic to the mutual and profitable benefit of both sides.
The Republicans in Congress seem quite intent to cut deeply into U.S. foreign aid programs, and they have focused on the International Fund for Ireland. Could you give us your opinion of the IFI and tell us what role, if any, it has in the peace fund, in the peace process? And a corollary question says, well, how can the U.S. afford to increase its foreign aid to Ireland by 50% at a time when it's cutting its own social programs very deeply?
Well, first of all, it's a matter for the United States Congress to decide itself what it wants to do with its money, the money that it raises from U.S. taxpayers. We don't believe that, in any sense, the United States has an obligation in the sense of any heavy moral obligation to subscribe money. But we believe that it is the case at the same time that this money is doing enormous good. It's doing good at two levels. First of all, because it's a flexible private sector type fund, it's enabled to invest in the sorts of business that wouldn't qualify for assistance from other sources. It's bringing people into employment who mightn't otherwise get an opportunity. And it's giving hope to thousands of families in Ireland, north and south. But also, by providing funds for a practical effort to solve what has, for 300 years, been an intractable conflict between two communities on one island who share different allegiances, that by providing financial help to a solution of that problem, the United States is setting a headline in regard to the solution of so many other problems which could be highly inimical to U.S. interests. For example, a conflict about Russian minorities in Central and Eastern Europe could cause havoc as far as U.S. foreign policy interests are concerned. Similar conflicts in other parts of the world, we've seen even conflicts of that kind in Mexico erupt, could cause havoc to U.S. interests worldwide. Peace, world peace, and a showcase example of peacemaking between two previously irreconcilable communities that have been at one another's throats for 300 years. That's something that's in U.S., in objective U.S. interest. And I believe that support for the Fund for Ireland and support for the process at this critical moment is something that is very much in the interests of the United States. And I think it wouldn't be in the interest of the United States, particularly at this juncture, for that funding to be cut off. Not because the funding in itself is of enormous significance, but because of the symbolic message that continued funding would give.
Can you predict or tell us what you would recommend for Ireland's involvement in NATO and in the European Union once the Ulster political solution is in place?
The government which I lead has decided that we will not, during our term, be joining NATO. But we are willing to look at an open with an open mind at appropriate arrangements for providing defence for the European Union. The European Union is not just an economic entity, it's not just a common market, it is increasingly a new political entity based on the federal ideal, the ideal that led to the foundation of the United States. So just as it is appropriate for the federal government of the United States to make arrangements to defend the federal entity that now is the United States of America, it is at some point in the development of Europe appropriate that the United States of Europe should make arrangements to defend that federal structure. When or whether we actually reach that point that Europe is so federalized that a federalized defense mechanism will be necessary, I can't tell. But certainly my country and my government, as strong supporters of federalism in Europe, have no problem of policy in regard to providing at the appropriate time support for a common defense of Europe.
How stable is your own political coalition?
I believe it's a very stable coalition. It's built on an arrangement between three parties who have very different views historically about how social policy and economic policy should be governed. But I think it is fair to say, if you look across most of Europe, that the old ideological divisions between parties who believed in nationalising things and parties who believed in privatising things, that those old divisions in fact have lost much of their force. Most people realise now, whether they be of the left or the right, that you must have a market-oriented system, but that it must equally be a market-oriented system that takes proper account of the social consequences of decisions taken in economics. And that you can't simply allow the market to work in an untrammeled fashion, but you must have safety nets, you must have arrangements for ensuring that the externalities are taken into account in the way that the market operates. Externalities in regard to environmental damage, externalities in regard to social damage. And it is on that actual convergence of ideological thinking in Europe that we, in our government, composed as we are of my party, which is Christian Democratic. I wouldn't describe us as conservative, we're a Christian Democrat party, part of the Christian Democratic movement worldwide with many important allied parties in Central and South America, can work together with a party of the left, the Democratic left, and with a party of the social democratic tendency, namely the Labour Party. Such parties are working together all over Europe successfully, and we believe our government will be very successful in that regard. We're also draw a lot of strength from the fact that we have a common analysis of the Northern Ireland issue. The three parties have a common analysis of Northern Ireland, which is the great emotional issue as far as Irish politics is concerned. And the fact that we have the same emotional reflexes on this very difficult question is a very important factor for stability in our coalition. But having said all that, no one can predict the future. I'm not going to make any statements about whether I'll be in government 5 years from now or 10 years from now, I don't know. But I believe certainly, as I speak, I speak as the leader of a very stable and very harmonious, and I hope, a good government.
Now, Fine Gael has led the effort in recent times to modernize the Irish Constitution and make it a document for all the people of Ireland and eliminate some of the elements that give one church special preference. Under your leadership, will you resume those constitutional reforms?
Yes. In fact, we will be promoting a referendum to remove the ban on divorce from our constitution later this year. And we have also established a body to take an overall look at the entire constitution and see how it might be reformed. We believe that our constitution should reflect the fact that nowadays Ireland, North and South, is a place where there are people with very radically differing views about lifestyles, about religion, and about social questions, and that the constitution must be a constitution for all our people, not just some of them.
This has been a presentation of the National Press Club and the Internet Multicasting Service.